This is Cave Scott Allen of OTCO.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Welcome to Herding Code. We are recording on March 31st, the day before the worst day for internet news of the year. This week we're talking with Eric Hexter of Headspring. And Eric, why don't you tell us a little bit about some of your activities at Headspring, and then we'll get into your other activities, which are related.
Fair enough. My title is a director of open source initiatives at Headspring. So I work on a lot of open source projects that we contribute to, but all of those really, I would say, contribute to our consulting business. So we use a lot of open source in our regular business. So I help kind of manage features we want to put in and donate to projects. And other than that, I also am a consultant for Headspring. So I go on site and do kind of boots on the ground work as well.
You get the tiny cubicle with the outdated computer and no pictures on your desk.
I'll say that's one of the great things about at least working at Headspring is I got a nice laptop with a lot of RAM, so more RAM than I can use. So,
yeah, I think has anyone on here not worked as a consultant, kind of a gun for hire? I didn't think so. We've all done the go on to the client site. Where's your cubicle near the janitorial closet? You know, with the broken chair, if you have a chair, and the CRT monitor with the 13-inch screen that you get to work with.
Right. Eight people in a closet. I've been there.
Yes.
My favorite was the place where they had such a lockdown security policy for the main computers that they bought everyone two computers, one that was IT approved and you got your email with, and then the other computer that you could actually use and develop with. And so, and then you had to like use Yahoo email to actually move files back and forth.
Nice. I worked at a place once where they actually put us in old call center cubes, which were about half the width of a normal cube, but twice as long. So, and there was no room to scoot your chair back. So you'd get your chair back just enough so that you could slide your butt in and sit there, and we were elbow to elbow. So, you know, all the lefties were screwed and the righties were, you know, always bumping their elbows. Okay, so in addition to working at Headspring, you also kind of bootstrapped the C4MVC online, what would we call that? Kind of a I'm going to say this wrong. Never mind. A series of lectures or presentations. Colloquium? No, that's not it. Gotta have been in a college too long. Anyway, you're also one of the primary contributors to the MVC Contrib project, aren't you? Or are you the PO, so to speak, on it?
Yeah, that's interesting. That I would best describe it as a co-founder of it. I'm far from being a primary contributor. I mean, I do contribute to it, but we have what's made that project so successful is there's been a lot of community additions to it. So it's more of just at this point managing the build and managing releases. And Jeremy Skinner, he's out of the UK. I mean, he carries most of the weight of really getting everything committed and checking code quality, and as well as his own. You know, he owns some features in there as well. But C4MVC, that I would call that a virtual user group. I am involved with the .NET user group here in Austin, and I wanted to get something based around MVC and kind of have the user group I would like to attend, but I just couldn't see pulling that off as a local user group. So it just kind of came up. I know you guys have had Javier on before. Mm-hmm. So we really just kind of took it off like, hey, let's try to do this online thing and see if we can talk to people and that we want to hear from and see kind of where it goes from there. And we've been pretty successful. So we have kind of the presentation type talks, which are good. Like we had Brad Wilson on, who's one of the developers on the MVC team. And I just remember when he was speaking, it was just, he was going over information that nobody else had. And even those on the outside that are going through the source code, you know, knowing that MVC is open source, just we don't have the same context that he has of exactly how they developed a lot of features as far as really understanding the extensibility. So it was great having, you know, people like him on that can really just go into the nitty gritty details. So that's really what I was hoping to get out of the group, was just get people who are really pushing MVC and developing applications. So not just the UI framework, but, you know, other things like that. So I've been really happy with the group, and we seem to be getting a lot of interesting folks who are interested in it. So that's a win all the way around.
And that's all done using it's run using Live Meeting, and is that provided by Ineta or something?
It is. So one of the benefits of being an Ineta user group is you get a Live Meeting account. So honestly, without that, I don't know how we'd run it. So we're basically running the entire group on, you know, the free Ineta Live Meeting account. I record them, and then we're using, I pull down the downloads of the videos, and then I upload those to Vidler using a free account there. So that's been going pretty well. We just recently hit a limit where they want to start adding ads to the videos because we've hit some sort of volume.
Wow.
So.
I think I remember hearing that those Live Meeting accounts were available to any MVP. So that's something to check out, because I mean, that's great. You're able to, definitely there's time and effort put in, but you don't really have
If I remember correctly, MVPs get a free Live Meeting account.
Yeah, I think
they used to.
Yeah,
they've cut a lot of stuff in the meantime, but I think that's still one of them.
I think it is, but I mean, as far as Ineta is concerned, if you're a user group that's focused somewhat on .NET, it doesn't have to be primarily .NET, but you present on something about .NET, I mean, you pretty much can qualify for a Live Meeting account. So it's a, you know, that for those who aren't and just want to get involved in community, that's something that's easily available.
Are there any real hard lessons or you know, things that you've had to learn along the way as far as how to set that up?
Where do I start? You know, it's like, you know, I'm first of all, probably the worst person to be a moderator of anything like this. So just kind of figuring out it, and it's almost like anything you do, right? It helped by first documenting what the process was to get people scheduled, getting the kind of the word out, and then walking presenters like ahead of time through kind of all the video setup. And we're still even learning some hard lessons as far as some little unique things around how Live Meeting records. Like if you're, let's see, one of the biggest gotchas I had was somebody's using a virtual machine and their resolution is, you know, some huge resolution. Live Meeting will actually record it at their native resolution. So say it's like, you know, 1600 by something, but it squeezes it down to, I think, 728 by 508. So there's just all these little things that, you know, these tips and tricks that I had to kind of learn along the way of, okay, you know, get your video to like 1024 by 768 and kind of do it that way. So yeah, there are a lot of things like that I kind of learned the hard way.
So you just announced MVC Comp a couple of days ago, didn't you?
Yes.
Announced, but you'd kind of bounced it around on Twitter, I think, a few times. I'd actually, when you announced that, I dug up an old post that I had about something I called DevBlogCon, which is kind of an idea of setting up, kind of doing something like a PDC or OSCon, but completely online, where you'd have different tracks, and the only commitment was that people would get on and like commit to posting a blog post about a topic, slides, and code examples or anything at a certain time. So if you wanted to, you could go through, but you could also kind of attend it whenever you wanted to. And I'm wondering if what kind of structure MVC Conf is going to have, and what do you expect to see in there? Can small talkers show up? Ruby, is it just, it's just for ASP.NET, I see, primarily, right?
I would say it's, the conference is really something that's growing out of the C4 MVC group. So I'd say the primary focus would be on ASP.NET MVC. And a lot of that is just because I have a lot of connections through the C4 MVC of people who said they would be willing to talk. But I kind of chatted with kind of the other leaders of the group. And so we're going to put it out there and say, you know, we can have a, if we want to call it an MVC.alt track. So if, you know, people doing the Rasta or maybe Monorail or FUBU frameworks, if they want to present, that's, you know, that's totally cool by me. I don't, I don't necessarily know if I want to get too much out of .NET, just because I want to still have it somewhat focused. But you know, I'm not going to squash it if people have got good content, because there's, you know, things to learn from every language and framework out there. If that makes sense.
Oh yeah, totally. So one of the problems that I have now is there's three technologies. If you're in the Microsoft kind of sphere of influence or platform, if you're devving on that platform, there's three areas of interest that are just being hammered, and I'm frankly kind of sick of hearing about them. Silverlight, jQuery, God bless it, and MVC. It's like you can't turn around without, you know, having someone post something on a weblog or an aggregate site or anything about one of those three technologies. Is there anything left to be said about MVC that hasn't already been said? What kind of content are you expecting? Is it going to be a rehash of C for MVC, or is it going to be brand new stuff covering MVC2, which has been being covered? It's pretty much been covered since MVC1 came out. The benefit and the curse of working in the open.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I guess the way I'm looking at it is, I could see, because right now we're planning on doing this thing in July, so I could see having, again, some ASP.NET MVC2 content, but I would really like to see, like, you know, deep diving into some extensibility, right? And really having some pieces around the MVC, the UI framework, but other, I'd really like to focus on building applications, right? So, you know, things around what's the best way to test, you know, really go into some of the nitty gritty details that, you know, people would normally see. And the other thing is, like, C4MVC, it's doing well, but it's doing really well in kind of our own little echo chamber. So the part of the reason why I kind of put it out there, and put it out there with a large lead time, right? We could pull this thing off and get it together next week. And, you know, maybe we have a few hundred people who kind of following the C4MVC on Twitter, they would know about it. But I'm really trying to get a bigger audience and hopefully expose them to things like unit testing, integration testing, UI testing, and some of these other things that, quite honestly, if they go to the ASP.NET website and look there, they're going to get some pieces. But unless they, let's say, dig into, like Rob Connery's video series, they might not make it through the entire series. They might not get into kind of all the pieces about what is building a maintainable app on top of MVC. So I guess one part of that is really looking to get a broader audience. But also by that time, I mean, we should be talking about MVC3 as well, I hope. But I also really hope to see, you know, people like doing open source projects around maybe database migrations and really kind of the other pieces of an application that you really need to pull all the pieces together. So I'm hoping we can get into kind of raise the level of what an application is and really talk about everything you'd need to build a maintainable, you know, enterprise app or a higher volume website, things like that.
And then the idea is like for MVC, these would be recorded as well, right? So if you can't watch a whole track or there's things going on at different times, you'd be able to catch up later.
Yeah. That's kind of the other pieces. Part of the reason I pushed the date out on this was I have a set of some automation scripts to really make the video thing work and to be able to do it in a way that's not totally, you know, manually intensive. So I'm hoping that I can have all that worked out so it's really easy to get all the videos up and, you know, we can just put that out in the open. So I guess they'll be good until MVC3 ships,
right?
Which might be the week after. Who knows?
So, Eric, you're looking for speakers, I'm sure.
Yes. So pretty much anybody who's interested in speaking, we have a spot for you because it's virtual, so I'm pretty sure I don't have a limit to my account. We'll see. But yes, if you go to the mvcconf.com, I have a nice little form you can fill out. But yeah, we're looking for speakers. I have probably half a dozen or so who've already committed, and I'm sure I can get, you know, maybe another five or six. So it's kind of the same way I do some of the code camps, because I've done the code camp here in Austin. So we always say we will not turn down speakers as long as they're willing to put in the time to kind of share some knowledge and help learn.
John, will you be applying to be a speaker?
I probably will.
Putting you on the spot here.
Sure.
Very good.
Kevin, will you be applying to be a speaker? Look how that works.
You'll show us how to integrate classic ASP with MVC.
You will exercise your MO. You'll show up and just kind of sit there for 55 minutes, and then at the end, you'll like say some awesome stuff, and that's the end. Cool. Was there any more to be said about C4MVC?
I guess the other thing I would say about it is, even though we are doing kind of these their code focused presentations, we want everybody to have, you know, their microphones and whatnot set up so that we can make it more interactive. So if anybody has a question, we can talk about it versus kind of the old school MSDN webcast that's, you know, just somebody kind of blowing through slides. So we really want it to be more interactive and feel more in real life. So kind of that being said, if you haven't gone to it, I recommend it. And we even had, in the last few weeks, we've had some intro sessions. So, and those have taken off pretty well. So, you know, definitely interested for speakers, but also anyone who wants to participate, you're all welcome.
Cool. Well, should we move on to something like, say, for instance, MVC Contrib?
Sure, I know a few things about that.
Well, so one thing I was interested in was the portable areas thing, and partly because I think some of it was relying on the multi-project areas, which was in MVC2 and then got moved to MVC Futures, and so I'm just wondering if that affected you guys or...
That change didn't affect us at all. So the way portable areas works, right, we build right on top of the areas functionality as far as registering an area. But really, the biggest piece of portable areas, there's two pieces of it. The one is an embedded view engine so that you can take your views in your area. So it's all in kind of its own separate project. You implement your controllers, your view, your models, everything you need within your area. But your views, you actually just make embedded resources. So kind of the magic sauce is the embedded view engine that's part of MVC Contrib. So that knows how to, from your portable areas, knows how to go into your portable area DLL and pull out a view and let the regular, if you're using the ASP.NET web forms view engine, it can pull it out and serve those to the view engine to render. So we didn't necessarily rely on some of that multi-project stuff.
I realized I asked this question kind of wrong, because we should talk about what portable areas are to start with, I guess, right?
Sure. So a portable area is, you can think of it as an area that's easy to distribute or easy to reuse between projects. So a normal area, if you're going to reuse it between projects, you'd have your DLL that contains your code. Then you'd also kind of copy along your view files. If you have configs in your view folders, JavaScript, CSS files. So the idea of the portable area is that we wanted a way to have a single DLL that you could drop into your bin folder and just start using that functionality. So thus the portability is easy. So that's what a portable area is.
So were portable areas born out of some specific application you guys were writing, or was it just sort of a, you know, wouldn't this be cool kind of an idea that you explored?
It didn't come out of a specific application, but I would say it more came out of the fact that as a consulting company, we have a lot of things that are, I guess, more plumbing and generic things that we'd like to use across projects. And pulling source code out from one or re-implementing something is just painful. You know, you hate to do it more than twice, but I can think of, like, there's some features, like, let's say you want to have a image upload component that, you know, you upload an image, it automatically resizes it into like a thumbnail and maybe two different other sizes. And then from another page, you want to be able to display that image. And I remember, you know, by the time we pull the controllers and all these service classes, it ends up taking a full day to pull over the code and all the integration tests to get that stuff working. So it was more of that. It's like, you know what, this should just be something that's easy to do. So it was more looking for kind of this reusability of just some basic features that you would expect the framework to have, yet, you know, it's just not mature enough. We don't have that kind of stuff yet. So it came out of trying to do multiple projects, really, more so than a single project.
So in portable areas, then you're using a message bus to communicate between the portable area and the rest of the application. Is that correct?
That's correct. So I talked about those two things that portable areas adds on top of areas. The first one being the embedded view engine. The second one being the message bus. So we wanted to find a, I guess, provide an easy way to communicate between a portable area and a host application. So we introduced the idea of a bus, and unlike you hear a lot about message bus and pub sub and kind of all these things that are in distributed applications, the major difference here is that the bus within portable areas is a synchronous bus. So from a portable area, if I needed some information from the host application, I can send a message. A handler will be registered within your application. So you receive the message, you do whatever you need to do. Say it's for like for a login portable area, which is you query your own data store and you'd return back, hey, I found the user and the password is correct, or some other error message. So it's just a way of defining the communication rather than leaving it up to, let's say, every portable area developer. Because if we didn't provide the bus, it would, you know, you'd probably have, you know, a few thousand different implementations of how to talk to a specific area. So we define kind of, as far as the bus, we define, I think, kind of commands. So a command would be a one-way message from a portable area into an application to do something. You know, a query where we send a message into the host application and we expect some sort of results back. And then we also have, I guess, what we're kind of calling events. So you just publish an event from your portable area and the host application may just do something with it. Like it might log that the event occurred. So it's pretty simple. And if you actually look at the code in MVC Contrib, the implementation is pretty simple as well. But just by defining the interface and having a clear separation between the portable area and the host application just hopefully leads people down the right direction as far as decoupling it as much as possible.
I've noticed a few other features in MVC Contrib are geared towards things like strongly typing. And I'm wondering if with the recent inclusion of T4 MVC into MVC Contrib, if that would have any kind of effect where like T4 MVC gets more deeply integrated, or you know what I mean? If there's any kind of like bigger solution where they all work together, or is that just kind of a separate thing?
I think what T4 MVC is doing is very, very interesting. And but I wouldn't say we would remove some of the other strongly typed features because we now have T4 MVC. I think it's okay to have kind of these two different approaches of this a code gen that happens in T4 MVC versus the Lambda type expression to do a lot of things within your application if you use the helpers from MVC Contrib. What's interesting though is now that some of that functionality is now making its way into the MVC framework. So what we will most likely do is start to deprecate some of the features that are now duplicate between MVC Contrib and MVC2. And we've done that in the past. I think when one of the betas or one of the RCs of MVC2 came around, we ended up going from maybe the only way I can really measure what happens in MVC Contrib is I do it by looking at our unit tests. So I know we deleted a bunch of features and we deleted the unit tests. So I think we went from like 1,200 something unit tests down to 1,000. So whatever that percentage is, that's about how many features we removed from MVC Contrib, knowing that now we're starting to have some duplication. So rather than have the duplication and do this, you know, common open source thing, which is my way is the best way and it's the only way that's going to work.
Right.
It's more of let's start relying more on the base framework. And if we have features that build on top of it, now we can start removing some of our implementation, but still keep our extra functionality that's built on top of it that could still run on top. I think like the input builders, that's one area that's very similar to the templating features, kind of this, I think they're now calling it this dynamic scaffolding. Mm-hmm. I still see the need for input builders, but a lot of the implementation can now go away. We can now rely on some of the MVC2 features. So that's the kind of the approach we take. But the nice thing is that we have input builders working on MVC1. So if people, you know, and companies are still, for some reason, can't move to MVC2 yet, you know, they can put the stuff in MVC1, and then you know, when they get around, they'll have a pretty stable upgrade path as far as the input builders.
I'm guessing one thing that, like you were saying, that had been deprecated, there's the Fluent HTML helpers, which is basically the strongly typed helpers that are in MVC2. Is that?
The Fluent HTML has still stayed in there because that's we've got that one separated into its own DLL. So the people who like kind of building that way still like building that way because it's more around chaining.
Right. Okay.
Chaining things together versus we did have some helpers that were I'm trying to think. There was one kind of like the like render action, and there's some similar things around that we made, you know, took Lambda expressions and were strongly typed, and now we're starting to see some duplication come over. So those are more of the things that we're starting to back away from.
Okay. And then are a lot of people using the grid? Because I think that's something that is pretty, like, from any other framework you come over and all of a sudden in MVC, you're like, oh man, I need a grid. And it's easy enough to render out a table of data, but to do any kind of real grid work, you end up basically just saying screw it and using something like JQGrid, or, you know what I mean, and just doing everything on the client side. So it seems like the grid is would be a pretty popular feature. Is that something people are using a lot?
I think there is, just by looking at kind of everybody asking questions on the mailing list, and, you know, there's people who are contributing to it, as well as Jeremy Skinner, who's really he really came up with it and is still adding features to it. I think a lot of people are using it, but the nice thing about it is that it is really all just kind of HTML generation. And it doesn't define what your client-side JavaScript would look like. So, like, out of the box, if you drop the jQuery data table plugin on top of it, it just works. So there's you kind of get that, where it can make maybe generating the initial HTML work out of the box, and then you could drop some Ajax love on top of it if you feel the need.
One of the things that I've noticed with a lot of these. A lot of things like MVC Turbine and MVC Trib and some of the other stuff that people have done with ASP.MVC, it feels like at some points you're almost, if not fighting with a framework, fighting with C# and the .NET framework. I mean, so some of the stuff you have to do, like making the views of the view engine an embedded resource, and your views an embedded resource, and having to pull them out that way, and some of the things that you have to do with the virtual path provider. When you do things like that, do you ever feel like you are fighting either, you know, the framework or the language itself if you're writing in C#?
I mean, you hit the nail on the head with the virtual path provider. That's the thing that really I personally feel the most pain around. And that's more of just the fact that out of the box, right, we're using the WebForms view engine, and there's a lot of baggage that comes along with that. So, I mean, obviously going with another view engine would hopefully make that easier, you know, something like Spark. But that's, you know, I definitely feel like we're fighting it there. I've been really asking for something that maybe integrates a little better than that, than how it currently integrates with the WebForms view engine. As far as, C#, my biggest pain around C# has been when we are doing strongly typed views and we want to reference a route based, you know, we have a strongly typed Lambda expression that gets us to an action on a controller, and we start refactoring the action. So if you go down the route and add multiple parameters or change your parameters for your action, and you start getting that refactoring, that seems to be the biggest pain point, right? Because then you have to add a post-compilation step to compile all your views in order to even figure out that, you know, this code in your views that will now we'll get a runtime error. So those are kind of the biggest pieces, but I'd say a lot of using the strongly typed views and using strongly typed languages, we've tried to gone down the route of, rather than trying to do dynamic things in the views, you know, if we're going to say we're going to use a strongly typed view model in a view, then let's, you know, really use the heck out of the strongly typed view and use, you know, do as many of the things that we can to help eliminate code. And, you know, I think the input builders are kind of an example of that. That makes sense.
Yeah, that was one of the things that I've had to do before is, and this will come up a lot as people start to build more MVC apps, is we wanted to somehow create a view that was going to be an HTML email template and send that, and it use the view engine basically to generate our dynamic email, HTML email to send off to users or customers for a variety of things, from, you know, marketing specials to, you know, reset your password here and those kinds of things. So it was so hard to write tests anytime you had to deal with view engine, because you ended up having to mock almost everything, and then you got, you know, to HTTP context and you're screwed. And I can't mock any farther. I've got to somehow run this under a web server. So it wasn't the act of rendering it that was the problem. It was being able to write the tests and decouple it so that we could, you know, so we didn't break it if we changed something else if we needed to, and also so we could do integration testing around the output. You know, we need to be able to capture that. And yeah, you could kind of do render action, but it doesn't return a string. It just, you know, says, okay, get the view or get whatever from here, this your action, and you know, use it in place here. And we looked at doing Spark as well, but you know, that had its own set of challenges in terms of, you know, then we got two view engines in there. Do we go ahead and change everything else, or do we do it in just this one spot? Or I think we ended up basically doing something like a string builder kind of to do the email template. We came up with something. I don't remember what. It's been a while. It's been over a year now since we did it.
And actually, because that's a feature that was in Monorail, right? Initially, is
right. It's in Monorail. It's in Rails. It's in, you know, everything.
Yeah. So MVC Contrib has that as well. Has a feature, and they've just recently got a set of patches to that to actually, you know, really rely on a strongly typed view. So the model coming in, let's say, you know, defines the to, the from, the subject, or maybe it's just the to and the from. So when we're rendering it, it actually just goes against the model and pulls that information out, and then uses some more conventions. But yeah, testing is definitely difficult. And if we've really kind of taken the route of if you get into the part where you're starting to mock a whole bunch of stuff, if it's a controller, then you're really doing something wrong. We pretty much never have to mock out HTTP context of any action that we're testing, but the view stuff, we've really been moving more towards using something like Watten or another web test framework. No, generating emails, that's probably a different story, because I don't know if you even expose those and make those available, you know, over the web server.
Yeah, I've seen people write, you know, gets into integration testing, but I've seen people write, you know, stub HTML servers and all that to do the testing against, but yeah.
Yeah, well, still, I think Steve Sanderson, right, he had something posted a while back. It was, well, it's probably been maybe a year, but, you know, I remember seeing on his blog that he posted, you know, this is how you spin up the runtime and load MVC and make sure the MVC handler is running in there. I love to see that thing turned open source and kind of brought into the community. But I know he's been busy. I mean, I think his book is pretty massive, and he seems to be working on that stuff and not so much, you know, definitely doing the open source stuff. So I definitely love to see if something like that, you know, either brought in MVC Contrib or, you know, just kind of somebody start kind of nurturing that and feeding that garden or those flowers, so to speak.
Well, and this kind of comes back to the general way that ASP.NET MVC has been developed at Microsoft, and stuff like Rail and Monorail kind of came from need. So these people were writing web apps, and at the same time, they were building the framework. So as things came up, they, you know, oh, we got to send email. So they built it in. Oh, you know, we need to be able to swap out view engines. Well, they built it in. And you know, since MVC came out of Microsoft, it's been kind of a, well, what would users want to do with this? And, you know, they are using it internally, and lots of employees are using it, building stuff. You know, they built Oxite, they've built Orchard, and they've, you know, I'm sure there's lots of sites that are up. They've certainly gotten feedback from the community, but it's the big disconnect between software done by consultants versus software, your frameworks written by consultants versus frameworks written by software companies, your IBMs, your Googles, your Microsofts.
I can see that go both ways, though, right? I mean, as you know, I work for a consulting company. We're never going to get to the level of testing, like of kind of overall of what it, you know, if we were to build an MVC framework, it would be very, it'd probably be very opinionated, and it would probably cover some very specific scenarios, and that either may mean it's very extensible or it's very high volume, but it's probably not both, because it was probably built just for a specific project, whereas,
and it may have certain levels, you know, of localization support for, you know, but maybe,
well,
not,
yeah, I mean, we're in Texas
tested.
so we're not going to give you any,
you just, yeah, you just speak Texan there, so you don't,
exactly,
have to test other than that.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, there's, you kind of get both edges of that. I know with Microsoft doing it, they're going to put a level of testing into it that, quite honestly, I don't think. And the testing I'm talking about is probably more integration testing on different web servers, as well as more performance tuning. That, quite honestly, I mean, I know we wouldn't do an open source.
I have to say, too, there's an ASP.NET discussion list at Microsoft, and there are constantly questions coming in, and a lot of them are from either big applications that Microsoft's running on ASP.NET MVC or from consulting services, and there's a huge amount of work that goes through, and you know, they're major projects, and constantly, like Brad, Alon Lipton, and other people on the ASP team are responding to these emails. So I think they're definitely, I mean, it's not just like they're these random devs sitting off.
Well, they're yeah, they're definitely not in a bubble.
Yeah, yeah, that's my point. They definitely are very aware of the pain points. I mean, you know, listening for feedback, but I'm just seeing constantly they're having to answer these questions that you know, people from all over the world are sending in about, you know, some pretty wacky scenarios, as well as, you know, just some common repeated questions and stuff.
But they're, you know, and I'm sure that some of the questions come from different size of corporations or from partners or from people who may have more influence into the general, you know, dev cycle. So if, you know, Boeing is building a vendor site on ASP.NET MVC, and they come in and say, yeah, we got to have this feature because this. It may hold more weight than if, you know, Headspring comes in and says, hey, we got to have this feature because this. That's just the way things get done in the cutthroat corporate world of software development.
Ouch. Yeah, I mean, I guess the thing that I've been happy about, I mean, is all the extension points are there. So if we need to do it, I mean, you know, like we had to implement areas, you know, in MVC 1, and we were able to do it. We're, you know, there's anything we needed to do, you know, so we implemented input builders. Now they have the templated helpers. But so every point that we needed to do something, we could do, and we had, unlike, I guess, all my previous experience with ASP.NET, is that I didn't run into something where, well, this was internal and this was sealed, and now I have to use some reflection magic to create something and modify it kind of runtime.
Right.
You know, those are the things that we're not running into with MVC, which, you know, at that point, it's you know, maybe I've just been beat down so much. I'm happy not to have to fight kind of some of these old problems that I used to have.
Well, and that's the benefit of them releasing source drops, is that they can look and see, okay, so what are people doing to get around, you know, some of the problems that we built in, or what needs to change within the framework for them, you know, this scenario to get enabled and for this to change. And I think input builders was one of them. And I'm trying to think of the other one, and I can't now. Oh, and I would hope they're looking at something like MVC Turbine and looking at the integration points there, and maybe internalizing those at MVC, just giving that level of control. I keep repeating that. Anytime we talk at MVC, I got to mention that MVC Turbine should be baked in. Javier owes me a beer, I think.
Or two.
Right. You know, going back just a little bit, but we were talking about testing and mocking and how that could be difficult, but you do have the test helpers. Now, those help some with that, the idea of, like, they'll help you initialize out context and requests and all that stuff, right?
Yeah, so, I mean, that's kind of the main MVC contrib release. You have MVC contrib, you have the Fluent HTML, and then you have the test helpers. And the test helpers, there's a few things in there. There's the one piece, which is what you're talking about, which is it kind of spins up a whole Rhino mock version of kind of all the context stuff. It has that in case you need to do that. But again, I don't use those as much, because that's usually like a way to spin up a controller with all the context stuff. And again, if I'm doing that, I'm probably, you know, my personal opinion is I'm probably doing something I shouldn't be if I'm accessing, you know, HTTP context from within an action. But it does spin it up. What I personally use those for is that you can use those along with the route testers. And probably the biggest thing I learned about doing routes is that if you're not testing, you should never add a route, right? Just go with the default route. But the second you start adding new routes, you need to put tests around them to make sure they're actually doing what you think they're going to do, because most likely they're not. And it's way easier to have tests around it versus, let's say, upgrading to another preview release of the next version and having things just totally be broken.
And that's something where that takes learning that lesson, right? Because I think in general, what you'll see is people will say, oh, great, I'm going to test all my controller actions and focus on that completely rather than looking at the whole application.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I probably spent about 45 minutes messing around with routes, seeing them not working, and looking at myself and going, what am I doing wrong? Well, you know, how come I... we already have these route testers. How come I'm not testing these routes? I'm clearly going the wrong path here. But yeah, I mean, you kind of just general rule. If you're going to add routes, use the test helpers in MVC contrib, and it'll make that much easier and kind of give you the ability to easily. And I think that's one of the things that's helped us at Headspring is that by having just high test coverage, it's really easy for us to move to new versions of the framework and know immediately something broke or they made a breaking change or some other thing has happened that means if it doesn't go right away and we maybe allotted an hour for the upgrade, if it can't happen in an hour, it's really easy to roll back, revert the changes, and having high test coverage gives you that I don't know, people call it a safety net, or at least the confidence of, okay, yeah, I think it's all going to work. We'll commit it and kind of put it through the full paces. The other piece that it does have is, and we recently added this, was some UI test helpers. And it's actually, right now, it's built around the Watton framework, but it's not tightly coupled to it. But it's really something, if you've, we had Jimmy Bogard do a C4 MVC talk, and I think he went and he did this talk at a few different user groups, but he kind of talks about some ways to do UI testing. So we have some UI test helpers in MVC contrib that really make it easy to do strongly typed MVC tests. So if you're already kind of bought into doing strongly typed views, then you can use your same models that you would use in your views to help drive some of your UI tests. So that's something that makes it a lot easier to do as well. But that's kind of a newer feature. We haven't blogged about it much because it's not totally, I wouldn't say it's 100% yet, but it's, you're probably getting 85-90% of what you need.
Now, is that taking the approach that he's blogged about where you actually share your presentation models, your edit models, and your view models sort of between the test side and the execution side?
Yeah, so you would share the models, and then probably the other thing you do is if you have certain identifiers, let's say you want to locate something by either an ID or by, if you do it by ID, you're most likely going to create the ID from something within your model, but you may also locate some other identifiers of inside your HTMLs, either IDs or CSS class names, but you'd also move those into some sort of string constant or something else that could be shared. Basically, what you want to do is allow refactoring inside your application and allow it in a way that it doesn't make your tests brittle, right? But yeah, it's definitely, it follows that exact approach.
One thing I really liked about his presentation was that it illustrates the point that using classes and IDs is about more than just CSS styles. Because I've heard people say that before, I added a CSS class and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, no, that's not a class, that's an HTML class. And it's used for styling, but it also has other purposes. And Jimmy's point here is, he's using those classes and IDs to tie in for testing, and it's beautiful. Like that's what an HTML document is supposed to expose with those, is it's a structured document, and so it's testable if it's designed well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And a big piece of that is you're designing everything for testing up front versus building a massive application and figuring out. I think the common approach was you build a huge application, you go to UAT, and then the testers get a hold of it and they try to start doing some user interface testing automation, and they spend a whole bunch of time doing it, and then you make some refactorings, and then you break all the HTML as far as they're concerned. So kind of out of our own need to. Because we don't necessarily hire just testers. We hire developer testers. So just out of our own sanity, we wanted to find an approach that allowed for refactoring, yet kept all of our UE tests working.
I think last time I checked, you guys still have subcontrollers in MVC contrib?
Yes.
And every time I suggest that, people tell me that I'm crazy. I don't really want subcontrollers. And so I'm wondering if you saw a use for them, or why they're in there, I guess, basically.
So I mean, it initially went in when we were looking at ways to really have a kind of a composite page, right? And have kind of widgets on a page, and each one has their own action logic that figures out what it needs to do for the model. But really what we found is kind of going the render action route is just simplified things versus just doing going the subcontroller route. So we've kind of really backed away from using the subcontroller functionality that is in MVC Contrib to using the render action. And I've kind of heard really both ways, you know. I think the argument against render action is you're putting a lot of logic, or you're coupling your views to start knowing about, you know, your allocation, and it shouldn't be. But, and it's hard for me because I've usually been a purist in almost anything. But at the end of the day, it just ends up being simpler to have a call to render action instead of a view or instead of a master page versus, you know, going through and maybe adding action filters that populate some data or call into something else to kind of get a subcontroller spun up. It was just more infrastructure and things that were just not obvious that caused, you know, more pain or harder to discover, you know, when you bring new developers on. So subcontrollers are still in there. They work, but you kind of, when you choose that route, it's most likely because you just feel that the calling render action from a view just is a code smell, and for some reason you just can't get over that, you know, that issue as far as how you want your views to look.
Okay, so we're talking earlier about testing, and I know one big change that affected me as far as testing with MVC2 was the whole change to the model validation. So instead of having all the code based validation, it was just kind of magically handled via data annotations and all that. And I wondered what your thoughts were on that. Like, first of all, are you fine with just saying, okay, this is handled by the framework, I'm not going to worry about testing it? Or do you go in and still, you know, figure out how to test that your validation is happening? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So prior to MVC2, we were using Castle validators. So we already kind of worked in our own model binder that would do that kind of the same things. And then when MVC2 came out with that, we started moving over to the MVC2 and just using data annotations. But so I guess before we get into that, you first have to look at what we've already bought into. So we've already bought into using strongly typed views and using, you know, each view pretty much has its own view model. And, you know, we used AutoMapper to translate our domain into our view model. So, you know, we've already kind of bought into the fact that we have some sort of class model that is going to be dedicated to a single view. So at that point, we're okay kind of adding attributes onto our models. But we really take the approach of the validation we're adding to that view model is going to be more data type validation, and we're not going to get very complex in what we're trying to validate there. So we kind of do data type validation there. And then as we get the view model, all the data types can translate into, you know, whatever the strongly typed view model or the input model would take. We then send that off into more of a command processor, and we let that do some more complex validation. That might validate, you know, if this is required, if and something else is filled out or something else is null, then this one's required, or combinations. And then it also might say, you know, uniqueness, like username must be unique, but we allow usernames to be changed. So if it's also equal to the ID of, you know, the user that we're trying to change, we allow it. So we've really kind of pushed that into using more of the command processor and using more of kind of a rules engine to handle the more complex. So usually what I found is if it seems like it's hard to do in data annotations, you're doing it in the wrong place. And I think I came to that realization when I was trying to do password and confirm password. And I realized in order to do this, I need to put an attribute on my class instead of on the properties. And, you know, once I realized, you know what, if I'm having this hard of a time figuring out the right place to put a data annotations attribute, then I'm clearly doing this in the wrong place. It shouldn't be on my view model. Put it a little farther down in my business logic.
Yeah, I ran into that. You know, I puzzled my way through that one too. I mean, there is a passwords match validation or validator in the account controller that, you know, shows a way of doing that. But you quickly get into like this date must be after this date, but both dates must be before, you know, and it just ends up kind of a mess. So that sounds like a good policy to do your data type and simple validation and annotations, and then use a rules engine for more complex things.
Yeah. I mean, your business logic's business logic, and you need to have that tested. So, you know, move that stuff into classes that are easier to integrate to unit test. as well as integration test, you know, multiple classes together versus relying on, pushing that into the data annotations. The other thing that is interesting is if you look at the Fluent validation, that is really interesting to me. We haven't moved to that, but we've actually considered pulling out some of the validation that we have in our command processor and just potentially just moving right to that Fluent validation because it's still code-based, we can still fully unit test it, and we can get definitely more complex than you might with the data annotations validation.
Let's see. Do you have anything you want to pimp or push or promote? Any other P words?
Let's see what else. Definitely want to push the. We have the MEC2 in action book that just went into like the what they call the MEEP. The kind of you can go online and get the PDFs. So go do that. It's with Manning. Definitely a big fan of continuous integration and testing and developing applications the way that they're maintainable. So go do those things. Oh, the other thing I would like to pin is Tarantino, the Tarantino database migrations. If you're not doing database change management, you should. I'll leave it at that. So the Tarantino is a T-SQL-based database migration engine. Some people prefer the code-based migrations, and if you do, that's fine. But if you're not doing anything, I recommend doing some sort of database change management and have migrations. And the one in Tarantino database migrations is based on T-SQL, so it's friendly to DBA types that don't want to let go of their T-SQL change scripts. So we put that in place, and we've been using that for a number of years. And there's actually a separate command line tool that you can help to automate your deployments as well. So check out the Tarantino project. It's on Google Code. I think that's about it. Oh, I know something. If I can jump into one other thing about some of the C4 MVC stuff.
Sure.
I've spent some time putting a lot of PowerShell scripts and scripting around how to automate a lot of the video stuff that goes along with running a virtual user group. So I've been talking with some of the people who do that the virtual alt.net user group. So we're gonna open source all of that code, and it it ties together some calls to the live meeting API and automates the Microsoft Expression encoder and kind of does all these things, and also automates Vidler using their REST API as well. So I've kind of chained together these scripts so that after we run a meeting, I can kick off a PowerShell script, and within a half an hour, I have the video processed and uploaded to Vidler. So if anybody's interested in running any sort of virtual meeting like that or your user group, I think recording those things as videos, that just helps everybody, because if somebody, their life goes on, their kids got sick or they got called into a meeting, they can always go back and, look at something that was interesting. So I'm going to put that stuff up somewhere, probably CodePlex. So if anybody's interested in that, you can contact me through my blog. But I'm definitely interested in helping people do that and help share information.
I should ask, there's one more question. When I put out a call for questions on Twitter, there was a common question, which was, how is Hexter so awesome? How does he do so much stuff?
Automation?
Okay.
I don't know. I don't get a lot of sleep. I've got two kids, so I know it's not that I'm working all the time. Yeah, automate. I say automate. Automate, automate, automate.
Okay, well, that's it for this week on Herding Code. We'll see you again next week.